Vinitaly is the world's largest wine and spirits fair with over 4,000 exhibitors and 150,000 attendees each year. And it's coming up on April 9th through April 12th in Verona, Italy. Members of the U.S. wholesale wine trade can enter Vinitaly for free this year. That's right, if you're a restaurant buyer, a retailer, or a wholesaler, you can sign up for free Vinitaly entry at vinitaly.com/freebadge. That's vinitaly.com/freebadge. So go to Vinitaly. Taste more Italian wines in one place than you ever thought possible. It's happening this year in Verona, Italy from April 9th through the 12th. And prior to that, there'll be all kinds of other amazing events happening in Verona as well, including the publication of the 5-Star Wines book, which is a brand new Vinitaly International Wine Guide, as well as the third offering of the Vinitaly International Ambassador Certification Course open to candidates from all over the world. And Opera Wine, which presents 100 of the best Italian wineries as selected by the Wine Spectator. All of this is happening in Verona in early April. But what if you can't make it to Verona? There will also be a Vinitaly International Academy certification course held in New York City this year, starting on June 26th, and that's going to go on through June 30th. If you are interested in becoming a certified ambassador of Italian wine and you'd like to attend the course in New York City, reach out to via@vinitalytour.com. That's via@vinitalytour.com with your contact information, and they'll respond to you with what you need to do. If you like Italian wine, there are great opportunities for you this April in Verona and also in New York City in June. So get there. $7.50 isn't just a powerful search engine for wholesale buyers. $7.50 also helps you quickly contact your sales reps with orders. And it keeps your order history organized and easy to find. If communicating with sales reps is a part of your daily routine, this is the most efficient method available for saving your time and avoiding headaches. 750 ordering comes packed with other features as well, such as text message alerts to your sales reps and transparent order histories. If you haven't already signed up for 750, you can create your own free account today at 750.com. 750 is the best and easiest way to search multiple distributor portfolios for wholesale pricing and availability, and the best way to find the details you need to understand your purchases better. Over 40,000 top on- and off-premise buyers all across the country have already embraced 750 for one simple reason. It saves them time on every order, each and every day. Find out more and sign up at 750.com.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Patricio Tapia of Wine and Spirits magazine and also the author of the Descorchados Wine Guide for South America. Very nice to have you here.
Great.
So you were born in Chile.
Yeah, I was born in Santiago in 1968.
Your family were into wine or?
Well, yes. My grandfather was a kind of a collector. So the first memories that I have about wine, on wine, is that, you know, those cases arriving at home. That was back in 1970-something, so pretty long ago.
I can imagine that's a long time ago also for the Chilean wine scene.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, although, you know, in Chile, we have a long history on wine consumption and also production. The last, let's say, that 30 years were the most radical in terms of change and evolution, of course, you know. So back in those days, in the 70s, the Chilean wine scene was just primitive in many senses. So people will talk about red or white, and that's it. And sweet, and that's it. On the market itself, it will be like, you know, not many labels available. And for example, the first time I published the Descorchados was in 1999. And I only tried like 500 samples. Now it's more than 2,000.
Originally just something you kind of did out of your kitchen.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the idea that came out. Because at that time, it was another wine guide made by winemakers, and it was a long, big group of people trying to be objective about wine. And in my opinion, that's impossible. So I wanted to just give another point of view.
So in the late 90s, that happened. In the early 90s, you started writing for El Mercurio.
Yeah, El Mercurio one of the oldest newspapers in South America. And it's very important in Chile. And I studied journalism. That's my main career. And then I was moving to live alone. I was 20-something. And I got this possibility to work in El Mercurio, writing about bars, about, you know, the things to do by night, basically.
Good time to do it in your life when you're
20.
Yeah,
that was the perfect job. The perfect job, of course. So I have a pretty intense nightlife, of course, because my job was that, you know, demanded that.
Gotta do the homework.
Exactly. You gotta do the homework, exactly. And then one day, probably in the early 90s, like 95, probably, something like that, the guy who was writing the wine column for the Mercurio decided to go other place, and the editor say, well, would you like to do it? And I went like, yeah, I need the money, of course. Love to. I have no idea about wine, but yeah, of course, why not? And that was the beginning.
And I feel like you kind of took it to a very professional level very quickly, because it wasn't that long after that you went to Bordeaux for a diploma program.
I realized that as a journalist, you know, you need to have good sources, and they need to take you seriously. Like more in a horizontal, you know, relation than a vertical relation. You know, you kind of see the guys, you know, at the same level or at least a similar level. It wasn't easy. There was a lot of things involved, as you know, in wine, and things that I never learned before, like winemaking. You know, what is that? First of all, I kind of like the idea of writing that wine column. I kind of like the people who were involved in the wine business, so I felt well. And so then I realized that I need to learn more. I did some research. No internet, not Google at that time, so I just asked. And everybody said that the DUAD, which is a diploma in winemaking and tasting in Bordeaux, was the best for me. I write them a letter explaining that I was, you know, a Chilean journalist. Nobody really was writing about Chilean wine. I went like, well, that could be important for, you know, the Chilean industry, blah, blah, blah. And they say, yes, come, pay, of course, and come. So that was 97.
And I feel like there was a lot of French influence later in, like, Michel Roland in Argentina and, you know, in South America, that you were right.
Yeah, and in Chile and in South America in general, Bordeaux is a big, big influence, especially in Chile. Many winemakers, you know, Cabernet Sauvignon is the main grape in Chile. Carmenere is also Bordeaux grape. And Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, now it's getting more and more important, but back in the 50s, or in the 40s even, Semillon was the most important white grape in Chile before all these Sauvignon Chardonnays arrived. No? The Bordeaux influences have been radically important in Chile and in Argentina.
There's a way that Chile and Argentina could be a little separated from the rest of the currents. It's kind of off to one side, literally. And it's interesting that there was such a conversation with the wines of France, and I guess that's because they were some of the most esteemed in the world. But I wonder if there's any other historical reason, like migration or something, that really affected Chile's relationship with Bordeaux wines and Bordeaux grape varietals.
There is a specific reason. You know, the difference between Uruguay, Argentina, and Chile in wine terms are huge, huge. The influence of Bordeaux is basically because of, in the mid 19th century, you know, these rich people from mining, you know, decide that they should, you know, see Europe. They spend long time in France or in Italy, but mainly in France. In France was like the Miami of our times. So every rich guy, you know, that could afford that, wanted to go there and spend, you know, a year there. So in those days, when they came back, they want to replicate what they saw there. So then, because they have the money, they build these beautiful, you know, chateaus and surrounded by vineyards. And that's the origin of many wineries in Chile, many important wineries in Chile. Cousiño Macul, for example, is a good example of that. So that was the beginning. And that influence, you know, is still really predominant in Chile. There are some technical reasons too. Bordeaux has these alluvial soils that are similar with the alluvial soils in Maipo. That's the most important region for Cabernet Sauvignon in Chile. So there is that too. But mainly, I will say, this idea of copy, you know, the high culture of France. You know. That's Chile. In Argentina and in Uruguay, this thing's a little different. Around the same time, there was this big migration from Italy, from Spain, and in Uruguay, from France, but not from Bordeaux, from other regions, you know. And in Argentina, you have this deep culture of immigration, you know, this poor guy from Italy or from France that has nothing to eat, and was escaping from misery in Europe and came to this new world, you know, trying to start a new life. And obviously, wine, olive oil, bread was part of his culture. So that's the origin of Argentinian wines. You know, that the immigration, the culture of this, you know, people arriving in Argentina, and the same thing in Uruguay. So the difference between both cultures are, you know, pretty evident.
Looking at it as I do from the Italian perspective, there's real evidence of that. Because like Giacomo Quinterno was born in Argentina, for example.
You know, I tell you this because to fully understand the difference between Chile, Argentina, and Uruguay, you should start knowing that, you know.
So you did a French tour of your own. As a Chilean, you went to Bordeaux, and then you often visited neighboring wine regions while you're in Europe, because that makes sense, because you're there already.
Yeah, I started with Bordeaux, of course, because it was just half an hour from my home. Then I also was lucky enough to get a job in an English magazine, drinks magazine. They hired me because I was there. That was a small magazine that not even exists. But I was a wine writer, so I could, you know, knock some doors, some important doors, luckily. So with that credential, I went to Burgundy, and I had the chance to taste beautiful wines. That was my first great wine experience. And I also went to Germany, went to Italy. I spent time and money trying to learn more. You know, Levi, that energy that you have when you're young. And when you discover something that you really like, so you want to know everything, you want to know all. So that was the energy that I had during those years. I still have some, not that much, but yes.
You still do the nightlife column?
No way. No, that's impossible. It's impossible. No.
That's the change.
That's a big change. I'm too old for that. Too old for that.
But I feel like you also made some friends while you're in France as well. Some people in the winemaking and chateau owners.
I still have some really good friends from that time, and many of them are dead, actually. Paul Pontalier, for example, was because Paul Pontalier worked in Chile, you know, and he still has his family has this partnership in Maipo with Viña Aquitania, it's called the venture, with Bruno Prats and all other people. This guy opened for me the doors of Margaux, you know, and gave me incredible wines. And just because I was Chilean, and he likes Chile, so that the main reason. And also Jean-Paul Vallée, he passed away in 2000. He was married with a Chilean woman, so I contacted him, and he was a good friend. He was a very good friend, but also a big influence in my wine life at that time.
How so?
To me, I consider Chateau Pavie the López de Heredia of Saint-Emilion. It was. It was. So when I met him, we have this beautiful long conversation about tradition, about terroir, about the influence of, you know, people in winemaking. And I was really the first great Saint-Emilion that I tried. The first great Bordeaux that I tried were made at Chateau Pavie. And I still have the, you know, that in my mind, I still have this, you know, this beautiful, elegant, refined style. Well, one year after we became friends, his family decided to sell the Chateau Pavie to Gérard Perse, which is is a businessman. He owns supermarkets and stuff like that. And he's buying, you know, several chateaus in France, and especially in Bordeaux. Well, so, and he hired Michel Holland, and everything changed immediately. I mean, he destroyed, literally he destroyed the cave, the cellar, and because he said that it was dirty or I don't know what. I was there when two main point of view of wine clash, collapse, you know. I didn't realize how important it was at that time. But now that I think about it, it was, you know, radically important in my own, you know, understanding of wine. This new modern, for that time, I'm talking about 1989, new modern vision of new oak extraction, masculine wines, confronting Jean-Paul's view of, you know, more elegant, putting your ego aside and let the terroir express itself through a bottle of wine. Of course, it was more with Jean-Paul on that vision, but it was really interesting to see those big forces, you know, fighting. And at the same time was this, 2 years later, actually, I think the 2000 vintage was the first that Roland made. And there was this beautiful controversy between Jensis Robinson and Robert Parker. One gave it like really low score, Jensis, to this monumental monster-like wine. And Parker gave it like, I don't know, 155 points, I don't know. So it was interesting to see that. And then when I saw that, I realized that I was there. You know, I was there. It's like, you know, it's like Lopez de Heredia changing everything and buying new oak. Can you imagine that? It's just nonsense.
And a point that you've made to me in the past, which I felt really resonated when you said it, was that that's a narrative that you saw happen in South America over and over again subsequently, where tradition met modern business and tradition went away.
Yeah, exactly. That's why probably it was so important for me in those early years, you know, to understand that it was this dramatic conflict between, you know, these two visions. I was lucky enough to be part of a TV show in South America, and we visit many, many wineries around the world. And I saw that many times, you know. For example, we were in Barolo. We have this incredible luck to interview Bartolo Mascarello months before he passed away. And at the same time, we interview Elio Altare. And we have these two interviews, one talking really nasty things about the other and vice versa. So again, these two forces, you know, fighting to prevail. Another beautiful one is Mario Sergio Nuño, the traditional producer in Bairrada, Baga producer, and Luis Pato. We try to do the same thing. We try to confront them, try to say things that can be, you know, as dramatic as the Barolo story. But no, they decide to get together, have dinner together, and laugh together. Although, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Luis Pato and Mario Sergio's Quinta das Vagueiras in Bairrada. Those wines can be more different. I mean, it's impossible. Until they can sit around the table and laugh and get drunk.
I thought it was interesting how you made reference to Bairrada when you were talking about Tanat in Argentina in your wine guide, because I don't feel like everyone writing a wine guide about South America would be readily making comparisons to minuscule old world wine regions. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of where you're coming from, though.
Exactly. And it's, you know, the Tanat is a beautiful grape, but as Baga are as in any great grape in any great region in the world, is really specific about site. And in Bairrada, for example, you need those chalky clay soils near the coast. In Tanat, in Uruguay, you really need those same kind of, you know, soils. Otherwise, I mean, if you put Tanat on sand, it's like the worst experience for your mouth ever, you know. The same thing with Baga. Although, you know, Luis Pato makes some really good bagas, old vines, baga in sand, the best baga wines came from these, you know, rolling hills near the coast in that area in Portugal. And in Uruguay, there is this incredible, beautiful place called Las Violetas. Old vines, again, in chalky, clayey soils that, you know, produce this incredible, you know, fantastic, austere, shy, timid kind of stuff, but with a big, super solid structure.
And so you ended up returning to Chile and writing this wine guide. And you started in the late 90s with the wine guide, which I feel like that was really when a lot of consulting money came through, when a lot of big projects were done in a more modern style. That's when, you know, certain countries in South America looked at exports as like something they could really conquer and really entered the scene, the world wine market, in a big way. So in between then and now, what did you start to see happening that were kind of dominant conversations?
Well, as a new region, South America, you know, always offer good stories for journalists, for writers. And you're right, at that time was critical in Chile and Argentina, because they, especially in Chile. Argentina started a little later, but in Chile, 98, 99 were critical years when they start showing their potential to the world, and specifically to the United States. The States and Great Britain are the main market for Chilean wines, for South American wines in general. So at that time, they were showing how good can they be, you know. And from those days, I remember tasting the first really great Sauvignon Blancs from Casablanca. The cool climate region was the news at that time, you know. And you have this beautiful Chardonnays, Sauvignon Blancs from the coast of Santiago in Casablanca Valley, and the central part of Chile, and then this classic Cabernet Sauvignons from Maipo, from Alto Maipo, up in the mountains, up in the Andes. So you have these two beautiful examples of the potential of Chilean wines. Those two wines were my first lesson in the first Descorchados in 99. And so I was really impressed that how they were showing, you know, the terroir, or a new terroir in the case of Casablanca, and this old tradition in the case of Maipo. Well, and Argentina started a little later, probably towards 2005. They appear in the market, and with the Malbec, that's already an old story. But that at that time, you know, I was really impressed how nice, approachable can be Malbec. If Tanat is the shy guy who is, you know, in the corner in silence in a party, you know, Malbec is the guy who takes the mic and starts singing, you know. It's like that will be the difference between these two grapes. And I wasn't surprised about the success of Malbec, especially in this country, you know. It was logic for me, you know, such a adorable, you know, easy to understand grape made an impact in this market. So those were the news, but now nowadays a lot of things are happening. Just at the top of my head, you know, for example, Itata in Chile, which is a very, very old area, winemaking region in Chile, you know, with 500, 600 years old tradition, now it's been recovering for the modern wine, and you can get really incredible wines from Muscat, made in the orange way, you know, or the Sanso, for example, a beautiful grape. And also the País, which was the grape that, you know, the Spanish brought to the country 500 years ago, 600 years ago. So you have this new, very old area that is emerging right now in Chile, totally different as the landscape is. You know, if you compare Maipo with Itata, they're just different worlds. It's totally different. In Argentina, I'm totally into this new idea of Malbec as a great interpretation of terroir. They are really into these high altitude wines, so you can really see how Malbec reacts when it goes to the up in the mountains, Tupungato, Wild Tayari, well, all the Uco Valley towards the mountains, and also when Malbec it grows in near the river, and so you can get all these new flavors that in the past were totally, you know, behind the extraction, the oak, and the ego of the people who were making it. Now things are changing, and there is this beautiful new generation of Malbec coming to this market.
And I was really impressed by how much your book highlighted that, because I think in my mind, coming from someone who mostly follows European wines and domestic wines, for me, I guess I often follow that stereotype that, oh, you know, these wines from South America are some, like you described from the earlier era, big, bold reds, sometimes with very soft tannins, either for quite a bit of money or very inexpensive, kind of at both poles, kind of like a Western Hemisphere version of Australia. But what you really highlighted in your book, in the Wine Guide des Orchados, is terroir differences. You have different sections on different valleys, and you highlighted numerous producers who are looking at different terroir expressions in different parts of Chile and Argentina, different places that we may not be thinking about outside of some of the main corridors, like outside of Mendoza, for example. There are other areas. And you also looked at people who are making wine with different grapes than we'd think of, not just the either Cab or Malbec axis, but looking at things like País that maybe have a historical resonance, looking at wine making production that isn't associated with Bordeaux in the 90s, you know, that maybe is more historical, maybe a little more rough around the edges. So I was surprised to hear about a lot of that. And I wonder if you could kind of take me through geographically, if there are terroir wines coming out of these countries, maybe we could start with Chile and you can just kind of lay out for me what the expanse of Chile is when it comes to wine.
Starting from north to south, I will start with Limarí and Elqui. That's the Pisco area. But since the last 20 years, they also produce wine, table wine. Again, there's this river and these chalky soils and the influence of the ocean. So it seems to be a desert, but it's actually some of the most interesting areas are influenced by the cold breezes from the Pacific. So it's actually kind of cool climate. And there, to my surprise, I taste some really incredible Chardonnays. As you know, Chardonnay is difficult if it's not coming from really specific areas in the world. But I was really surprised about how salty those wines were. And I, some descorchados ago, I put them on the spot because I thought it would be interesting for readers to try those new Chardonnays. And some good Pinot Noir, too. Well, when you move to the south, you will find Aconcagua, Casablanca. And again, in Chile, the influence of the coast is radically important. Also, the influence of the mountains. So in Aconcagua, now there is this newly planted area near the coast where, you know, there's a nice expression of Pinot Noir in schist, which is totally rare in Chile. They discover a spot, and on the wines, I don't know if we have any good example of Pinot Noir growing in schist. Probably in the Rheingau, right? There is this guy, I just don't remember his name.
Kessler or something.
Kessler, yeah, exactly. August Kessler, exactly. He's a really great producer when you talk about Pinot Noir on schist. Well, this guy, Errázuriz, Errázuriz is a big winery with a really bright winemaker, Francisco Wettig. He's making this beautiful Pinot Noir on schist that totally blew my mind. And then when Casablanca is the original cool climate region. And there is this new tradition, Sauvignon Blanc. You got some good Pinot Noirs. You got to move to the coast. Casablanca goes from the mountains to the coast. So obviously, you know, the regions closer to the Pacific are more interesting in terms of climate, but also in terms of soils. There is this granitic soils that are really, you know, good for Sauvignon Blanc and granite. I love that. And also some good Pinot Noir. You know, Monsecano. Monsecano is a really nice producer from Casablanca, from the coolest part of Casablanca. And he's making really good wines. André Ostertag is involved in that project. You know André Ostertag, the producer from Alsace? He's involved in that project. And you should try it. It's really nice Pinot Noir. I mean, it changed your mind about... It will change your prejudice on, you know, Pinot Noir from Chile. They're really interesting wine to taste. And then there is Maipo. It's the classic region in the surrounding of Santiago. And there is the Cabernet Sauvignon is king and Cabernet Sauvignon on alluvial soils in the both sides of the Maipo River, especially towards the Andes. That's our own Medoc. And then when you go south, there is this Maule area, again, with a long tradition, granitic soils and Carignan. Carignan, we just discovered Carignan like 10 years ago. Before that, it was just another obscure grape for bulk wine. There's even an organization, a group of producers trying to give Carignan the dignity that it deserves. there's a beautiful discussion about how Chilean Cariñan should be, you know. It should be more like Priorat, like more concentrated, more powerful. It should be more like Southern France Cariñan, lighter, more easy to drink, more Vin de Soif kind of wine. So there is a lot of Cariñan. And then south of Maule, there is Itata, Biobío, and all the southern region. The other day I was there, actually I was there last week, and I visited a producer and asked him, how old is this vineyard? He went like, I don't know, 200. That's how deep and strong is the wine culture there. And there you get Sanso, you get Pais, and this Muscat, and this really strong Muscat. It's interesting because Sanso is light, it's a red, but with the logic of a white. It's light and beautiful to drink by the pool. And Muscat is made with a skin contact, is strong, you know, tannic, like a red. Really interesting. That's Itata, Biobío, beautiful Pais. Pipeños are made there. Pipeño, I don't know if you know about that. Pipeño is it's our own Beaujolais, you know. It's the wine made by an early consumption, light red, can be white too. And Pipeño is the wine that most represent the Chilean wine culture. You know, it's the regional wine, if you want to call it like something like that.
And what about the earthquakes that have happened recently? Did those hit certain zones in particular? And what was the aftermath of that?
The earthquake in 2010 and the wildfires, like a month ago, they affect a lot, especially in Maule and Biobío, so the southern region. You know, I had the chance to visit the region right after the earthquake, and it was like a war zone. It was a very, very big one, you know. We're used to that. And we have several important ones in our history, you know, recent history. But that one affected the region, particularly Maule and Itata, Biobío. It was a disaster. It was a big disaster. And then I don't know how many millions of liters of wine, you know, just ran away. 2010 was a really great vintage. But with that black spot. And then the wildfires a month ago. I was there last week, as I said, and I don't know how to describe the landscape after a fire. It's just so violent. I mean, the fire is so violent when attack an area, and it was out of, you know, any knowledge. I mean, I get into a region in Maule, and I went to visit this winery, this old vineyard winery, and on the road to get there, the landscape was just, you know, hell, literally.
Have you seen wineries have to close or restructure because of those natural events?
Not the big ones, of course, but many small producers. The wildfires and the earthquake attacked specifically, you know, especially those small growers, those small Pais growers, those small Carignan producers and growers. The most affected ones were those small producers.
Because I think of Chile as big producers and small producers that probably I don't see too much here, but I imagine that they're there.
Yes, one of the differences between Chile and Argentina is that there in Argentina, because of this, you know, migration, the idea of making your own wine is something totally natural. While in Chile, it's true, it's more industrial. So when you think about making wines, you think about millions of bottles. You never think about 500 or 1,000 bottles. When you study winemaking in Chile, they will teach you how to make big quantities of wines. I mean, anyone can make wine, but you need to study to make huge quantity of wine. But now in Chile, thanks to these new areas, new regions, these old, actually, regions, now we have a new movement of small growers. And also in Chile, more than in Argentina, you know, these big companies don't allow to the winemaker to have a side project. But that's changing. Thanks God, that's changing. That's why now, or in the near future, you will see more of these, you know, small artisanal projects coming to the market.
With a wine culture like that, I could really see how corporate decisions become complete landscape and culture decisions. Because if someone says, okay, we are a large producer, we've decided that Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay or Carignan or Cabernet is going to be a big deal. So we're going to plant 1,000 acres of it. And they have the resources to do that. And then all of a sudden that becomes a major market segment. You know, that's, there are a lot of bottles as a result. And it can kind of change on a dime like that. And it might change a few times because people might change their mind and be like, no, it's not working out. We're ripping it all up. We're grafting it over. We're going to try something else. You know, it was too hot. It was too cold. We didn't like it. Didn't sell. So following that kind of market is, I feel like, a very different thing than following something where there's appellation controls, there's a long history, maybe there's a less large producer influence.
One of the things that I think is more important to change in Argentina and in Chile, and at some extent also in Uruguay, is that, I mean, I totally understand that you need to get some money out of this because this is a business, you need to live, and you need to pay your rent, you need to pay your people. Perfect. I'm not against that. And if you're in that business, it's okay with me. But if you sell the idea of terroir, and if you sell the idea of wines with character, you can just now see the market. I mean, you just do what you need to do. And producing your wines, making your wines, looking at the land instead of the, what's going on with the last trend in New York, you know, and try to copy that. And that was a big fight that I have with many, many producers that are trying to sell you something they didn't want to buy, or you're smart enough to not to buy it. And when all this terroir idea of, you know, all this terroir marketing tool started to appear in Chile and in Argentina, you will find a lot of that stuff. You know, people will tell you, oh, you look, this Malbec is, you know, is originally from here and you can smell it. And you went like, come on. I mean, that's what the Americans want. What do you think the American would like to drink? So that's a problem. That still is a problem. But I don't blame the big companies to that because, you know, it's their business and they need to sell bottles. But I really encourage small producers to do the opposite because they need to do what they need to do, and that's it. And all these new guys producing, 5,000 bottles, 10,000 bottles, are trying to do what tradition tells them to do or something totally new. Something that they believe is the right thing to do. So that's why, for example, there are all this idea of Pipeño, País, all this idea of, you know, making wines in amphora, because not because it's fashion in the geeky community, but because that was the way we used to do wine, you know. So, there is a lot of that. There is a lot of people who's trying to conquer the market. And one day they will plant Syrah because Syrah was hot in 10 years ago. But now they realize that nobody is selling any bottle of Syrah anymore in this market. And now they're asking what's hot so they can plant it back in Chile and do something about it.
You mentioned López de Heredia before. Are there producers like that are just kind of a more exportable quantity of bottles kind of doing their thing over a long period of time in Chile? Are there names that I should be thinking about?
Cousinho Macul is one of them. They have this long tradition of making elegant, you know, subtle wines a la López de Heredia, similar to that, but not really. Now they have been changing a little bit the style, but still they're the most traditional ones in Chile. I can think of López in Argentina. López is like the López de Heredia of Argentina. López is a big, huge winery in Argentina. They located in Maipú, which is an area within Mendoza. And they believe that the wine should stay longer in cask because you need to have the wine at your table when it's ready. And sometimes it's ready after 15 years. Sometimes it's ready after 20 years. So if you taste a López wine from Argentina, you will have the chance to taste really old Malbec because they think that's the right thing to do. They don't give a shit about, you know, what's hot in the Brazilian market or in the American market. They just do what they need to do.
So for the Chilean wine scene, as you've covered it since the late 90s, who have been the key figures in Chile, whether that be producers or sommeliers, restaurant owners, critics like yourself? Who are people who have really shaped the current scene of Chile?
There's the older generation of winemakers that started to change, like Ignacio Recabarren, for example, in Conchetoro, Pablo Morandé in Morandé, Aurelio Montes in Montes Winery, several others, Cecilia Torres in Santa Rita. So this old guard that started to sell wine abroad, and they started to make commercial wines, wines that people in another country will understand. So that's the first step. And then there's another generation of winemakers that started to, you know, see their job not just as a lab rat, you know. They started to see their profession also as a PR thing, you know. So they were the guys in charge of producing and selling the wine. And so this later generation, people who now has 50 years old, 55 years old, they make the change between the lab rat and the new rock star, you know, which is actually a really important change. And then this new generation, the generation that is like 45 years old, they are making all these big changes, like, you know, discovering Pais, discovering Sansó, discovering Itata. I can think of, for example, Marcelo Retamal of De Martino is one of the strongest forces in Chile right now. And also Francisco Bedic of Rasuris, Rodrigo Soto in Veramonte, and many, many others. And now they're in charge of this new era of Chile, you know, trying to tell a story with deeper roots, like Itata, for example, like Pais. So that's a new generation. And there's one thing about this new generation that I didn't see it before. These new guys are more curious about what's going on outside Chile. In the previous generations, they were happy to taste a Bordeaux or Napa. And when they want to work in a harvest abroad, they will pick Napa or Bordeaux. So they're expert on Napa and Bordeaux. While this new generation is more like, oh, let's try to discover, you know, what's going on in Georgia. Oh, so let's go there. Yeah, let's see what's going on there. Oh, what's going on in Jura? Okay, let's go. We need to go there. We need to discover those wines. And it's the first generation, as far as I know, that are buying wines from other regions, from other countries, which was totally unthinkable 10 years ago. And it's the same thing in Argentina, the same thing in Argentina. When I brought a bottle of, you know, Jura, for example, to them 10 years ago, they were like, what is this? I need to know this. Now they know more than me about it because they devoted to investigate what's going on around. To me, that's the main change in the mentality of the winemaker, the new winemaker in Argentina and in Chile. In Argentina, of course, there is Sebastián Zugardis, Alejandro Vigil, Matías Michelini, Gerardo Michelini, and several others that are changing the way Malbec is produced. But also those guys are investing a lot of money, their own money, buying barrels, traveling to other wine regions in the world, learning. I think probably they understood that if you like to read, you don't read just one author, you know, you like the idea of reading other voices, the same thing with them. So that's why I think that small, obvious detail now is so important. The main influence now is not Bordeaux anymore. The other day I went like, I have a conversation when I was this winemaker, and we were talking about Dujac and the way, you know, he used, you know, the whole bunches and stuff like that. That conversation, it would be impossible 5 years ago. But now they're totally into that. And they're learning, of course, they're learning. And there is one interesting thing about working with a whole cluster in Argentina, in Mendoza, especially with Malbec. Malbec is not a grape that has really strong tannins. So in the past, they used to bleed to get the structure, you know, to get the structure of the tannin extraction that you need. So it was a little fake to me. And now they're using whole cluster. So they get those tannins from the skins and from the green parts of the wine. And the change is radically different. Just it's amazing to see, to taste all this whole cluster, a little Beaujolais-like, but still with that firm, you know, solid structure.
What percentage of people are you saying are doing that with Malbec in Argentina?
All these new guys, all these new guys are doing that. I mean, first of all, with Malbec, the harvest window of Malbec is huge. So you can pick one day or you can pick 2 months later. Depends on what you want. Back in the days of Roland influence and Paul Hobbs influence, which wines were really success in this market and made a strong influence on all the other producers in Argentina. Back on those days, they will tell you, no, Malbec needs to be really ripe. And so you need to harvest really late. Why? Since Malbec doesn't have pyrazines that, for example, Cabernet Sauvignon has or Cabernet Franc has. Why is that? This guy started thinking Malbec from another perspective, you know, is harvesting earlier. They discovered that they didn't find any vegetal notes. They discovered that they new flavors, new fruit flavors, new red fruit flavors that were totally hidden with, you know, this over extraction and over ripeness. So a whole new world opened at that moment. And people like Vigil, Alejandro Vigil in Catena, Matias Michelini, again in his own project, Passionate Wines, called his project, Juan Pablo Michelini in Sorsal, another nice name to keep in mind, are doing that. And the results are great. I love Malbec because of that. I also made Malbec in Chile.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. I produce wine because I need to prove my theories. And I started doing Malbec because I wanted to prove that theory of the window, you know, and the lack of pyrazines. I made Malbec from Casablanca, a cool climate. It's pretty good.
That's unusual for a wine writer to do that, to say like, oh, you know, I'm going to make this to prove this idea that I have actually can work.
Yeah, I did it several times already, but it's super expensive. It's super expensive. I mean, I don't have the money to do it anymore. All the time. You know, you need to spend time there. But you learn a lot. You learn a lot.
What about Argentina in terms of the geography of Argentina?
Well, 70% of the wines are produced in Mendoza. Mendoza and satellites, you know, San Juan, San Rafael, all that area, which is the most, by far the most important area in Argentina. There, Malbec is king. You have these amazing results and amazing differences between what is produced in Agrelo, which is the most traditional zone area in Mendoza, where all the really old vines are, and all the big names are located. No? And that's near the river, with a lot of sandy soils and pebbles, and a very good site for Malbec. If you want to go for this ripe, you know, supple Malbec, that's the best place to do it. If you're wise enough and don't overripe your grapes, you will get one of the most balanced Malbecs in Argentina. Beautiful ones from Agrelo. I love Agrelo. Luján de Cuyo, in general, is that traditional area where the best Malbec that came into this market came from. Luján de Cuyo is the place. And then when you go out from Luján de Cuyo, you go to Valle de Uco, which is the highest part of Mendoza. And there you have Altamira, for example, Juan Tallarí, those names that start now to sound a little bit because of these guys, like Vigil and Catena, like Sorsal, and others. And there is something different. There you have chalky soils. That's a desert. I mean, there's nothing there. All is gray. There's no vegetation. There's no trees. Mainly is this huge presence of the mountains there, like a big monster, you know. And then this desert, you know, just coming down from the Andes. And there you get some of the most exciting Malbecs are coming from that area, but from specifically chalky, sandy, gravelly soils. Some of the best Malbecs right now are produced from grapes in this particular area of Uco.
It comes up a lot in your book, The Wine Guide. It's mentioned quite a bit, the Cantena early experiments up until now.
Exactly, totally great. And then you have these two other regions, which is Valles Calchaquíes, which is up in the north. Crazy, totally crazy, up in the mountains, in a super high altitude, 2,200 meters above sea level. So it's pretty high, and you get headaches when you get there, and everything is rustic, everything is tough, you know. If you think by the Uco landscape is tough, it's nothing if you compare that with Salta, which is the main city there. Sandy soils, gravelly soils, where you find, you can find Tanat there too, but again, mainly Malbec, and this beautiful, really strong Malbecs. That's changing too. There are some people who think that there's no reason to make monster kind of Malbec there. There is also the chance to do something lighter, and the first example of that are, you know, really, really interesting to taste. Well, but the image of Salta Malbec is strong, a monster kind of red. Well, and then there's this beautiful Torrontés grape, which is a cross between Pais and Moscatel, I think. So native to Argentina, nothing to do with Torrontés in Galicia. There's no relation. And it's flowery, rustic. It's like a Viognier with moustache, you know. It's really, really a unique grape, but on that direction. I love Torrontés. I love Torrontés with chicken empanadas in Salta. Rustic wine in from a rough area. And then the south, you will divide Patagonia. Patagonia, you know, that name already takes you to a different landscape, a different atmosphere. And there you have some of the greatest Pinot Noirs from South America are coming from Rio Negro, which is the oldest side. Neuquén in the north is the new part, the new money, you know, investing in wine, in vineyards 20 years ago. But Rio Negro has a long, long history, going back to 300 years. And there is this super old vines of Pinot Noir there. And then there is this Malbec tradition too, again, some great semillons from these alluvial soils again, in a beautiful, beautiful landscape. So that would be Argentina in general. Of course, there's new regions. The newest one, or the most interesting one for me at least, is Chapad Madal, which is in the north in Mar del Plata, right north of Buenos Aires, right next to the coast. And really interesting Sauvignon Blanc, cool climate Sauvignon Blanc, and Chardonnays. And also a little bit of Pinot Noir. Trapiche, which is the gigantic Trapiche, has invested there and together with a local. And they've been producing already for 3 or 4 years, and the results have been interesting. So that's a new region that will be, you know, probably we will hear more about that in the future.
Do you think that there's a lot of investment and experimentation going on from larger producers?
One of the best examples that people from the establishment are doing crazy things, including a Pais grape in the Marqués de Casa Concha line, which is one of the most important lines in Conchitoro. So it's nothing to play around. It's just, you need to be serious. And Marcelo Papa, which is he's the winemaker, he decided, why not to take a risk, even in a such a risky place like Marqués de Casa Concha. So that kind of thing are happening a lot. For example, there is Tara, that line of Ventisquero. Ventisquero is a big company. I mean, they produce a lot of bottles, and they sell it by millions. But they also have this small project called Tara from the north in Huasco, in the Atacama Desert. There's nothing there, nothing, no water. And they decide to make wines there, to plant vines, and they discover a little vineyard, and they produce this natural kind of stuff. You know, if you put a Tara wine in any Joe Dresner tasting, nobody will notice the difference. So I'm enthusiastic about those crazy things, because it's a sign that things are changing for the good.
What do you think the challenges are for Argentina? Like, what's the roadblock?
The main challenge, the first time I started to do the Scorchados in Argentina was like 6-7 years ago. But I've been visiting Argentina for many, many years. I had some, you know, Argentinians are Italians. They're passionate. You know, they in Chile we're more like shy. You know, we hide things. We don't want to tell you the truth in your face. I have some of the most interesting, to put it somewhere, and passionate discussion with Argentinian producers about the idea of having just one point of view. You know, I totally respect the work of Roland and the work of Paul Hobbs, but I wasn't agree at that time. I'm talking about 5 years, so 5 years ago, no more. That was the only way to make wine. I mean, I love the idea of having a more extracted, you know, very ripe kind of stuff. But also, I like to have another vision. So my main fight 5 years ago, 10 years ago, in Argentina was trying to explain that it was nothing against him or against them, but it was like I don't like the monopoly, and they were making a mistake. Once they said I was a spy hired by the Chilean government to destroy the Argentinian industry. Now things are changing, and I I think Argentina is flowering. It's flowering. I mean, there's no much better time to visit Argentina anywhere, especially Mendoza. I mean, Mendoza is a beautiful place to go if you like meat, and than Argentina today for a journalist and for a wine geek. It's you will say something earlier about prejudice. You will destroy all those prejudices if you go there and you talk to these new guys who are seeing some things different. No, those sweet, heavy Malbecs anymore. These are nice, light expression of the grape.
And they're finding a market?
I hope so, yes. I hope so. What do you think? I mean, what is your opinion?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a little bit like the same situation for Australia. I always thought that the person who had it the hardest was the one that wasn't going with the dominant style all that time, because it's so hard from here to realize the needle in the haystack of the person that's not in the dominant style that I would like. It's not that I wouldn't like that wine. It's just I just don't know about it. And so I think that makes it harder when it's someone going the other way.
Yes. I think the message of this new Chile, this new Argentina, I think it has been well received by the wine community in New York. One of my goals is to help to send that message through the Scorchados.
And speaking of that, I mean, Brazil and Uruguay, which you also cover for the guide, are even more frontier for me. I mean, I've tried probably less than 5 Uruguayan wines. I've had maybe 1 Brazilian wine. So if I were to think about those countries, what should I know?
The climate in Uruguay has nothing to do with the desert of Argentina or Chile, you know. Somehow Atlantic in a good way. It's more rainy. It's not as hot as in another part of South America. There, Tanado, with the thick skin, you know, can produce some really interesting wine, but you need to be really careful. And they were ashamed of that. You know, they were ashamed of their wines because they will say, oh, well, you know, people won't understand because there's Malbec, this guy, you know, who is so easy to understand, and our Tanat is complicated, it's tough, it's rough, it's everything's about structure. There's no aromas there. So they started to overripen it, they started to cover it with new oak, and they were happy with that. And we went like, what is that? This is a disguise. I mean, why are you ashamed of showing what really is, you know? You're not really being honest with the public, with the consumers. The trend that I see in Uruguay that makes me really happy is that Tanat can be strong, a Baga kind of red, and even Barolo kind of grape. But also, when you produce it as a light swimming pool kind of wine, it's wonderful. I mean, if you like Beaujolais, you will love those carbonic maceration Tanat. There is this new generation of producers that are trying to, instead of putting a mask, trying to show another face of the same grape, but being honest with the grape itself, you know. And that's the thing that most attracts me now about Uruguay. And also these new ventures towards the coast. That are beautiful. You need to go to Uruguay. Uruguay is like Argentina, small, and with these beautiful beaches and the great meat, great food, long tradition, really long Basque. Tanat is a Basque grape, you know, brought to Uruguay by Basque people. It's interesting. It's really interesting. And then Brazil. Brazil probably, I don't know the prejudice you have with Brazil, but Brazil is samba, is happiness, blah, blah. Well, you should go to Vale dos Viñedos.
Because they're unhappy all the time. Terribly sad people.
Terrible sad people. No. Vale dos Viñedos is like being in Piemonte. It's beautiful. The Italian influence there is huge. It's huge. The immigration in Vale dos Viñedos goes back to 200 years ago. And there you have this beautiful sparkling wine. They have this idea of they need to produce the best sparkling wines possible. And some of them are great. Made with French grapes like Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Muscat also. They produce a kind of Asti that's really interesting with 70 grams per sugar, but still good. It's a cool climate. The landscape is fantastic. It's like being in Italy, but with Brazilian people, which is really a weird mix, but it works pretty well. Valle dos Viñedos is the place to know if you want to start learning about Brazilian wines. You should start for that. There are the main wineries, and also there are this food and wine culture. A lot of great restaurants with local Italian food made by Brazilian people. No caipirinhas.
Where in South America is there infrastructure to visit? Because some of the areas we've spoken about are essentially deserts, and they might be great for making wine, but I don't know about a first visit. So,
in that sense, Argentina, Mendoza specifically, is so well prepared. So well prepared. I mean, the hotels are really, really good. The restaurants and wineries, as a restaurant now, they're fantastic. I mean, I like meat, of course, but since I'm from Chile, from the coast, I like better have fish. There is impossible. The trouts from the Mendoza River are good, okay? But then there's the vegetables. There, the tomatoes, Levi, are out of this world in Mendoza. I mean, it will change your idea of a tomato if you try one of them. The garlic is fantastic. So they made this incredible salad with onions, garlic, tomatoes, and a little bit of vinegar. And it's just heaven. Again, good restaurants, really good hotels. Mendoza is so prepared, so well prepared for receiving tourists. In Chile, also, the Casablanca Valley, the restaurants and the wineries are really, really good. If you need hotels, you go to Valparaíso, which is a beautiful old city, a port. It's a port with a lot of character, you know. It's like they say it's like Lisbon of South America. I don't see any much connection, but it's still, I mean, it's about the character of the city. And Maipo is Santiago, but there is Colchagua. Colchagua is another traditional valley south of Santiago, like 2 hours drive, with beautiful hotels and stuff. So I think South America is well prepared. It's well prepared. It's far away. So, I mean, if you from New York, it's like 10 hours.
Flight. I was shocked by that. When they told me how long it was going to take to get to Patagonia on a flight.
It was like a long time.
I could be in Japan by that time.
Exactly. I mean, if you go to Argentina and Patagonia, let's say, it will take you at least 16 hours to get to your hotel in Patagonia. Forget it. I mean, it's really far away, but it's worth the try. I mean, it's a new area with a lot of tradition, which seems to be a contradiction, but it's not. It's like a lot of things to discover.
How many languages are we talking about between those four countries? I mean, how many dialects?
No, there's no dialects. I mean, we speak Spanish with different accent. Of course, in Brazil, they speak Portuguese and Italian. But yeah, the accents are really different sometimes. But if you speak Spanish, normal Spanish, regular Spanish, it will be easy for you. Most of them in the wine industry, they speak English.
Even in Argentina with all the Italian and Spanish immigrants?
In Argentina, less than in Chile, of course. But still, you know, now they speak English to you. Now, you know, they've been selling wines abroad for the last 20 years. They've been learning many things. One of them is the language.
So if I want to go on a small producer tour of South America, if I want to look at some of the wines that I don't know from the export market here, obviously you have a wine guide that I could use as a great resource to do that. But what are other resources to do that?
Well, in Chile, there is this movement called MOBI, which is a group of independent growers. Some of them really good. Some of them really good. That would be a good source to contact them first. And they have contact also with small artisanal producers in other parts that are not part of the group, but also their friends. So I will go to MOBI. Of course, read the Scorchados. That's first on the list. And then in Argentina, there is no such a group, but in Argentina, you need to go and ask for the Michelinis, the Vigils, the Zuccardi, and people like that, which are big, but also they have their own project. When I go to Argentina to produce the Scorchados, one of my favorite days is the day that I have with the Michelinis and all the satellites. I spend the whole day tasting projects that are sometimes 500 bottles. So it's amazing how this the group has this satellite, these people who is working with them, but also they produce their own wines. And yeah.
So since the late 90s, you've been making Desorchados, the wine guide, and that's a, you know, as we've spoken about, an era of a profound change in South American wine. What's going to happen, do you think, in the next 10 years going forward when you write the 2027 version of the guide? What's that going to be like?
There is a movement right now of big wineries getting bigger and small wineries getting smaller in a good way, in a good way. I think right now there's these giants like Trapiche, like Conchitoro again, you know, these huge wineries. And they're going to be huge and they're going to stay there. But the important thing in Chile and Argentina is that there is this new idea of producing your own wine. So it's going to be even more fun in the future to discover all these new visions. As I said, my fight in Argentina was the monopoly, one opinion. And now there are many, many opinions. And I want to believe that that will be the future.
Patricio Tapia sees a future for having an opinion in South America for wine. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Patricio Tapia of the Desorchados Wine Guide, a writer for Wine and Spirits, as well as El Mercurio in Chile.
Do you want to learn more about a particular subject or region? Check out our playlists. You can find our playlist tab on our website, alldrinktothatpod.com, alldrinktothatpod.com. And say you want to learn more about Mosel wine or German wine. Listen to the German wine playlists and you'll find them all in one place. Want to learn more about Burgundy? You can listen to the Burgundy playlist and get all the Burgundy episodes right there at your fingertips. Happy listening. We have over 400 episodes of the All Drink to That podcast, but iTunes will only show you the latest 300 episodes unless you hit the subscribe button. So go ahead and hit that subscribe button. It's free, and you'll be able to see all our episodes, and you'll get our newest episodes even faster.